today, how the coronavirus pandemic is moving India ever closer to becoming a surveillance state.
So the app appeared on April 2nd, but it didn't really take off until Modi kind of urged Indian people in the name of kind of helping the government to download the app. And it was then that in the space of one day, they had 50 million downloads. It was the fastest download app ever on record. As of a few days ago, 83 million people had downloaded this app.
From the outside, it might look like the Indian government has been successful in its handling of coronavirus. The country has a relatively low death toll and was quick to develop a contact tracing app, which helps users find out how at risk they are of catching or spreading COVID-19.
People will kind of do anything to help stop the spread of coronavirus. They're willing to be sort of foot soldiers in this war. And if it's as simple as downloading an app, people are very willing to do it. Without really acknowledging the sinister side to it, that you don't really know the kind of long-term implications of inputting your data, how it will be used, who is going to have access to it, whether it'll be part of a wider mechanism of surveillance on public health or even something beyond that. That is something that, you know, in the hands of the Modi government could have pretty scary implications.
The Guardian's Southeast Asia correspondent, Hannah Ellis-Peterson, has been reporting on the implications of people downloading an app in a country ruled by an increasingly authoritarian nationalist government who were restricting civil liberties before the pandemic even began. Now some fear that this crisis is being used as a pretext to erode the rights and freedoms of Indian citizens in the name of winning the war on coronavirus. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, has the coronavirus pandemic accelerated Narendra Modi's authoritarian agenda? Anna, coronavirus arrived in India after a year of huge change in the country. We've covered this in previous podcasts, but I think it's worth going through what's happened. Nearly a year ago, Narendra Modi and his BJP party won a landslide re-election. From reading your reports, it seems that two trends have developed since then. First, Modi's really accelerated his Hindu nationalist agenda, revoking Kashmir's special status.
The Indian government has scrapped constitutional provisions giving special status to Indian-administered Kashmir. Home Minister Amit Shah's announcement comes as the region is under lockdown, with all communication lines now suspended.
And then the government introduced something called the Citizenship Amendment Act, which gave citizenship to refugees of all religions except Muslims. This caused massive protests against the government, which led to a backlash and the worst violence the country has seen for decades. The second trend that's emerged is an increasingly authoritarian way of governing in India. The government has passed laws allowing increased surveillance and frequently shuts down the internet, as well as arresting activists and holding them without charge. So it feels like India is on a very troubling trajectory. And then coronavirus happens.
Sampurna desh mein sampurna lockdown hone ja raha.
Modi announced a lockdown towards the end of March with very little notice, causing mass panic as millions of workers tried to return to their villages. This pandemic has changed pretty much every country on Earth, but how has it changed India? Has it altered that trajectory that it was on?
The arrival of coronavirus just kind of fueled what you could describe as already a kind of well-oiled machine of hate in terms of Hindu nationalism and authoritarianism. This all really starts with the gathering in mid-March of an Islamic organization called Tablighi Jamaat.
All right, we are getting you a big exclusive right now. These are the inside visuals, the first visuals of the congregation inside the markaz, in fact, at Tablighi Jamaat, which is at Nizamuddin, which very clearly show you how there are too many people at one place. Social distancing norms are not being followed, and that is why it has resulted in such a big health scare.
It's important to note that India wasn't locked down at the time. It was, you know, unwise, certainly, but it wasn't illegal. So this gathering occurred over a couple of days, and then afterwards, thousands of people went back to their villages across India, and it slowly emerged that many people, it's unclear exactly how many, had picked up coronavirus at this gathering. And this gathering got seized upon by the media and by BJP leaders as being the kind of source of coronavirus in India.
India continues to see a surge in coronavirus cases linked to the Nizamuddin Markaz. On Monday, fresh cases were reported from multiple states, including Uttar Pradesh and Rajasthan. Tamil Nadu and Delhi remain the worst hit by infections generated by the Tablighi Jamaat event. The cases could spike as test results of hundreds of Jamaat members in quarantine are still to come.
The police were sent out to search people. Rewards were given to find people who'd been at this convention, you know, in the same way you would look for kind of criminals. And the rhetoric that was used around the people at Tablighi Jamaat was just so volatile and so violent. They were accused of coming together to create a conspiracy to fight corona jihad.
India should have been free of coronavirus by now. But these Jamaat members have acted like suicide bombers. These suicide bombers should face the strictest possible legal action. They should be punished in a way that generations to follow will be too afraid to commit such crimes.
And it became this sort of very prevalent idea that actually coronavirus was a Muslim disease. As I said before, there is this kind of very well-oiled machine of hate. And as soon as you have these narratives, it just feeds into it so easily.
And was this starting to have an impact on the lives of Muslims across the country?
Yeah, a very kind of real effect across India. So you were having the boycotts of Muslim fruit and vegetable sellers.
Earlier this week, a legislator from the governing Bharatiya Janata Party told his constituents not to buy vegetables from Muslim vendors.
Muslim vegetable vendors are spitting on the vegetables, putting saliva on them, and then selling the vegetables. So I told them that we can't do much about that, but don't buy vegetables from them.
But then also on a more sort of tragic level, there were reports of two separate women, Muslim mothers, who were turned away from their hospital when they were giving birth and their babies died. Reports of vigilante groups beating up Muslims, you know, to protect their villages from corona jihad. You know, the sort of terrible thing that happens is that the jump in India from kind of fear to violence is so small.
That culture of misinformation feeds into the second theme we're talking about here, this creeping authoritarianism in India. One of the first tactics in the authoritarian playbook is to crack down on freedom of speech and the free press. Has coronavirus provided a pretext for the government to do this?
I mean, absolutely. That's something we've really seen in the past few weeks, which is the kind of, you know, increased harassment of journalists who are trying to hold the government account for coronavirus. I mean, prior to this, you know, I think it's fair to say that a lot of mainstream media is already under the thumb of the government. There are some very significant and very important exceptions to this. And one of them is this publication called The Wire.
My name is Siddharth Vardarajan, and I'm founding editor of TheWire.in, which is a website in India.
Siddharth, can I hear a bird in the background where you are?
Yes, you can.
What is it?
It's probably a peacock. Central Delhi is full of them. But because of the lockdown, they have become more free in their movement.
Oh, really? I see. Yeah. So you're getting more peacocks at the moment. Can you tell me about this article you published on the 31st of March? What did it say?
So we ran what I still regard as a very routine story. The news of the day was the discovery of dozens of infections at the Delhi headquarters of a Muslim organization called the Tablighi Jamaat. So we had a story which described what had happened in this place and, by way of background or context, mentioned how religious organizations and establishments in India have been quite late to realize the importance of social distancing. By way of an example, we mentioned the Uttar Pradesh Chief Minister, Yogi Adityanath, who is with the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. And despite the announcement of a lockdown by the Prime Minister, Adityanath had essentially violated the lockdown by taking part in a religious function on the 25th, which was the first day that the lockdown was supposed to start, in the presence of literally dozens of people. He released video footage of this, and hardly five or six of them standing at the edges had masks. I guess the analogy that we were drawing with, you know, irresponsible behavior by a Muslim organization and irresponsible behavior by the Chief Minister was an analogy that he didn't like. So they decided that they would try to make an example of us.
And what happened after you published the article?
I should also inform your readers that as part of the original draft of the article and a tweet that I put out, a quotation from a Hindu religious figure in Ayodhya, where he said, "Lord Ram will save us from the coronavirus," obviously a pretty ridiculous statement, was mistakenly attributed to the Chief Minister, which we subsequently corrected. But the media advisor to the Chief Minister latched onto that tweet and said, "This is fake news." Lo and behold, on April the 1st, this guy, the media advisor to the Chief Minister, puts out on Twitter copies of two police complaints charging me personally and The Wire with all kinds of ridiculous crimes. They allege that I was trying to provoke a riot between two different communities and disobeying a lawful order of a public servant and violations of India's Information Technology Act, all kinds of rubbish, basically. They followed that up by sending a posse of policemen, this is in the middle of the lockdown, to my home in Delhi to issue a summons for me to be present at a police station for questioning. And I should say that I'm not the only journalist to face the wrath of the police. There have been others who have been charged with fairly similar quote-unquote crimes for reporting shortage of PPE equipment, shortage of food.
Your website's been pretty fearless in holding authority to account in India, and in return you've been harassed quite a lot by those in power and had several defamation claims made against you. But, you know, did this feel like an escalation? Have you had criminal charges filed against you before?
This was most certainly an escalation because, you know, the filing of defamation cases is pretty much the standard preferred route to try to shut media up. And we have collected our fair share of these cases. What was done this time, to my mind, it's of course a first for me and for The Wire. It was important for us to not take this lying down. So we were, you know, very clear from the start that we're going to fight this tooth and nail. I'm very happy to say that the media community in India and abroad has stood firmly by us because they recognize that this is a danger that everybody is going to have to confront sooner or later.
You've talked about how these charges seemed absurd, but they were also very serious. How did they make you feel? How did you feel about this?
You know, it's you know, frankly, I'm not the sort of person who worries a lot, but when these kinds of charges get leveled, it preys on friends, you know, family, well-wishers. So, you know, you then start getting, you know, calls from people saying, you know, be careful. So there's, you know, it's clearly intended to, you know, ramp up the stress factor on the intended target, but it can't stop us doing what we do. It can't silence us. But I think the greatest burden that this kind of offensive places is on freelance reporters, you know, reporters who don't have the backing of an employer, of a media organization. It becomes impossible to do journalism, right? If you're going to be looking over your shoulder, everybody will simply self-censor, will play safe, and will think 100 times before they do stories that annoy not just really powerful people like the Prime Minister or Chief Minister Yogi Adityanath, but also the local police chief or the local city councillor, whoever has the ability to, you know, pick up the phone and get the cops to file a case. So this is what's really worrying.
After this, Hannah reveals the sinister implications of India's contact tracing app. Hannah, we've talked about journalists like Siddharth, but has the government also been muting other forms of criticism and dissent too?
Well, so what's been happening during coronavirus, if we're talking about kind of this atmosphere of authoritarianism, is the Delhi police seem to be using this as an excuse to round up activists who were at the forefront of the anti-government protests against the Citizenship Amendment Act at the end of last year. It's unclear exactly how many they have actually arrested because of the kind of lack of information that's coming out. But certainly at least three women have been charged under a law called the UAPA, usually reserved for terrorist activity. And these activists have been accused of masterminding the Delhi riots, which were the kind of devastating religious riots that happened in Delhi in February. And this terrorism law means that they can be held on with no charges and with no bail for 6 months. And this is happening at a time when the courts are kind of all but not working. So applications for bail are much more difficult to put through, where no one can take to the streets in protest. Meanwhile, the BJP politician who is on record as having made these incendiary comments.
The BJP leader Kapil Mishra has given a three-day ultimatum to the Delhi police now to vacate Jafarabad and Chandbagh roads where anti-CAA protests are going on. In fact, he makes a thinly veiled threat as he does this.
Which, Hindus and Muslims alike will, recognise that these comments provoked the riots, provoked the violence that began the riots. You know, the government and the police are saying it's not the right time to arrest him.
Hannah, all over the world at the moment, governments are asking their citizens to give up certain freedoms. We're all being told to stay in our homes, but we're also being asked to relinquish our data and privacy through the use of contact tracing apps as part of the effort to slow down the spread of coronavirus. But from everything you've said, I feel like this sounds very worrying for many in India right now.
And I was talking to Arundhati Roy about this, the Indian author, and she described it as India kind of having previously been moving slowly into a surveillance state. We're now panic running into a super surveillance state. You know, this is an emergency. You know, coronavirus was just, spoken about as a war. And so we're all kind of foot soldiers in this war. And in a war, you do sacrifice some of your civil liberties. You know, freedom is something you're willing to give up. Privacy is something you're willing to give up. You'll give up, you'll allow surveillance in the name of winning the war. And this has become, I guess, most prevalent with this app, Aragya Setu.
Mujhe corona se kitna khatra hai?
Seedhe Aarogya Setu par chale aao na.
Aarogya Setu app mein register now par click kare. App ko location sharing ki anumati deni hogi.
I mean, it's similar in many ways to a lot of the, contact tracing apps which have been introduced. But it looked particularly to the models of China and Singapore. So you input data about yourself. So your name, your age, your travel history. It enables Bluetooth and GPS, which enables them to monitor the people that you come into contact with around you. So other people who have the app, and it'll indicate whether or not you have come into contact with a high or low risk person. And it operates on a traffic light system. So you get green, yellow and red, depending on how high risk you are.
I'm standing at India Gate, but in times of lockdown, how would I know that whether I'm safe? And in these times, the Aarogya Setu app can be handy to let you know whether you've come in contact with any COVID positive case. I've downloaded that app and you can see that red, green or orange zone is visible. Here I'm in the green zone, you are safe, it says. And if you go down a bit, it will tell you that how it really traces contacts through a very complicated algorithm and gives you the results.
So all the information that the app collects is then sent to an external server, which is under the control of the Modi government. And particularly if you're deemed high risk, so you fall into the red or the yellow category, your location information is also sent to this server. So the more high risk you are, the more data they will collect on you and the longer they will monitor you. India kind of built it in 2 weeks with complete lack of transparency. So the actual functioning of the app you know, and how it's kind of built and how the information is transmitted is very unclear. And I guess the most crucial concern above this all is that India doesn't actually have any data privacy or surveillance laws and no privacy laws.
Do people have a choice about whether they have to use this app?
Well, so this is the kind of crux of it, really. Currently, yes, but increasingly more and more measures are being introduced to ensure that actually that choice is taken away. So all military employees now have to download it. All public and private employees have to download it. All government employees have to have it. There's talk of you having to have it to get on public transport and to move into public spaces. It'll only let you on public transport if you have a green certification from the app. This could have huge consequences on, you know, people's freedom of movement, as it did in China. People found themselves somehow classified as red, and then they couldn't leave the house and they couldn't do anything. And then that therefore impacts on your ability to work, to live, to buy food. So you've got this kind of app which can determine that you've basically got coronavirus without ever having actually been tested for it.
That's terrifying.
It is, because there is no kind of accountability mechanism to offset it. I spoke to the kind of person from the Ministry of Technology who helped develop the app, and they said privacy is at the core of this app, but you really only have their word to go on. There's no limit on the lifespan of this data. There's no sense of when it would end. There's no kind of binding assurances that it won't be amalgamated into another database, so it won't become a kind of mechanism of kind of public health surveillance. But there's also another kind of important flip side to this, which is that only 36% of people in India actually have access to the internet. And it's unclear actually how many of those is through smartphones. So if you come to a situation where in order to leave the house, to get on public transport, to, you know, move around freely in your own country, you need to have this app. You then need to have access to a smartphone. And it means that people who don't have access to this, then their freedoms and their ability to live in India and to, you know, have a livelihood are limited.
Right. And we know that India is a country with huge levels of poverty. Not everyone can afford a smartphone. So it feels like this could have a profound impact on people who are already disadvantaged. We've been talking about the app, but are there other ways other than contact tracing that authorities are keeping track of people?
Yeah, states like Karnataka and a few others published the names, addresses, date of birth of every single person who'd been abroad and every person who was under quarantine. In some states, they've ordered people to do geotagged selfies. So those who are in quarantine have to take a selfie and then send it into the police. In Delhi, they stuck red stickers outside the door of people who were under quarantine. It all has very sinister implications, because it's just giving, you know, local authorities access to the locations of all these people, and also putting a lot of this information out in the public domain, fueling this already kind of growing stigma towards people who have the virus.
Hannah, you've told us about the various ways in which it seems India is moving in a much more authoritarian direction since this pandemic began, with an increased crackdown on journalists and a less of an undermining of liberty through surveillance. How dangerous do you think this is? And are people seeing this as a heavy-handed response to a crisis that many governments have struggled to deal with, or perhaps something more profound?
I don't know. People have kind of celebrated Modi's response to this. I mean, what I'm talking about, the kind of concerns over privacy and surveillance and authoritarianism, they have not been splashed across the front pages of Indian media, and they're certainly not dominating the conversation. The conversation is that, and I think this speaks to, you know, how much of a grip the Modi government has over mainstream media, which is that, you know, Modi is doing brilliantly. He's done far better than they did in Europe. He introduced a lockdown, you know, preemptively, and therefore, you know, they kind of make comparisons saying, you know, we've done so much better than Italy, than the UK, than the US. Oh, everyone thought India would be, you know, a disaster, and look at us, we've done really, really well. There's sort of 85% approval rate for Modi's response to coronavirus. So I guess the scary thing is that a lot of the stuff that I've raised today is really not being discussed at all, except in a few publications and by people like Siddharth.
Before the coronavirus crisis, it was very clear that the trend line of media freedom was headed down. There was also a trend, surrendering of responsibility by constitutional institutions, a steady attack on what we regard as the secular foundations of our republic. The pandemic has allowed, or has created the conditions for the government to double down on all of these different trends. So the situation today is far more bleak than it was at the start of the year or at the beginning of March when we woke up to the fact that the pandemic has to be taken very, very seriously.
Siddharth, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
There's the peacock.
Exactly.
It's like they know that you're doing a podcast. You can read Hannah's reporting on this and more at theguardian.com, where you can also keep up with the brilliant coronavirus coverage our journalists around the world are doing right now. Thanks to Hannah and Siddharth for speaking to me for today's episode. It was produced by Joshua Kelly and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Anushka will be with you tomorrow.